Anton is the award-winning author of the historical fiction series Rashi's Daughters, and now Rav Hisda's daughter. Maggie was raised in a secular socialist household, and when she reached adulthood, she had little knowledge of her Jewish religion. All that changed when David Parkhurst, who was to become her husband, entered her life, and they both discovered Judaism as adults. She is now a Talmud scholar with expertise in Jewish women's history. Maggie is also a clinical chemist in biochemical genetics. Welcome, Maggie. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Introduce us to your novel by telling us about the main characters.
Okay, the main character is Rav Hisda's daughter. Her name is Hizdaduch, which actually means Hisda's daughter in Persian. And we are talking about 3rd century Babylonia. Not everybody's on the top of their know-where-it-is place. So it is modern-day Iraq. We're talking about the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates. And her father, Rav Hisda, is one of the rabbis who is in the process of creating Talmud. Talmud doesn't exist yet, but this is the beginning of the discussions between the various rabbis that will eventually turn into the Talmud. So she is our heroine. Her father's one of the main characters. And also we have 2 suitors of hers. And this is actually how I became intrigued by Rav Hisda's daughter to begin with. There's a little section in Talmud. She's about maybe 9 years old. She's in her father's classroom. And depending on the translation, she's either on his lap or she's sitting next to him when he calls up his 2 best students, Rami Bar Hama, Ava Bar Joseph, and he asks her, "Who do you want to marry?" Now, this, of course, is rather interesting that, first of all, she even has a choice, right, in 3rd century Babylonia. Normally, it might be, here's the guy and the wedding's tomorrow. But she has a choice between 2, and the 2 guys are standing right in front of her. It makes it a little more dramatic. And not only are they standing in front of her, they are in front of the entire classroom of other students. And how does she reply? She says, "Both of them." Yes, very interesting. And the younger of the 2 guys, arguably the more quick-witted, says, "I'll be the last one." And the Talmud tells us that is indeed what happens. They consider her a prophet because she knows that first she marries the older one, has some kids with him, then she's widowed, then she marries the second one, and has another family with him. And when I read this piece of Talmud many, many years ago, I was so intrigued by this story. Like, who is Rav Hisda's daughter? How could she say both of them when asked, "Who do you want to marry?" So I never got her out of my mind.
So she existed. She's a real person. And so is her father.
Absolutely. She is the woman who is mentioned in more different places in the Talmud than any other woman. And her father is one of the heads of what they call a yeshiva, Talmud Academy. He's teaching all these students. And the 2 guys that she eventually marries both become rather famous rabbis as well in the Talmud. So, yes, they are historical figures.
Talk about the research you did for this novel. You only have to read about 5 pages and you are, I was so amazed at the depth and breadth of your research. Talk about that.
Well, one thing I got to tell you about my research, for me, writing is the hard work. Research is the fun part. That's why I didn't do Rashi's granddaughters. I had it with the 11th and 12th century. But researching into 3rd century Babylonia, it's a time period that most people do not study. It's not like I'm writing about the Tudors and how could you find anything new. Everything I found was new. And the history of Judaism in and how the Talmud is created in this milieu was very important. Also, that happens around this time is that Emperor Constantine becomes a Christian, and then Rome becomes a Christian empire. That has implications for world history. But the part that really intrigued me, which I didn't even realize I was going to find, was the magic, the sorcery, when you think of magic, I mean, frankly, the word magic comes from the word magi, who are the Persian priests who are there at this time. And when you think of this time period, you think of like guys on flying carpets and genies in bottles. I mean, the whole mysterious magic world of astrology comes out of this time and place in Babylonia. And as I was trying to find out more actually about women's names, just so I had authentic names for characters, I came across research on a subject called Babylonian incantation bowls, which were more like cups than bowls. They were buried face down under houses and were created between the 4th and 6th century. So the same time the Talmud is being created, these bowls are also coming into existence. They are written in Aramaic, the same language as the Talmud. They're using Hebrew text characters. So we know they're written by Jews. They call upon Jewish angels. They call upon the secret names for God. And their purpose is to protect the inhabitants of these houses under which they're buried from the evil eye, from demons, from illness, from all kinds of nasty stuff to happen to them. And they are essentially spells and incantations for the, we would call white magic, good magic. And they are ubiquitous. They have found thousands of these in Iraq, particularly since 1991 when the Iraq war was and there was a lot of looting and not too much security. Many of these bowls, I mean, some towns under every house, and they've came on the market and scholars have started studying them. And there was some Jewish scholar of the Kabbalah who says, nonsense is nonsense, but the study of nonsense, now that is scholarship. So the study of magic and the study of ancient Jewish magic tells us a lot about the lives of the people who commissioned these spells and these amulets and needed their help in their lives.
The Bible and other religious texts call for the death of women who practice sorcery, yet many in the ancient world practiced their skills freely. How did society accept these women?
For the most part, at least the ladies in or the women in Babylonia who were sorceresses were doing a public service. They were healers. Most of the bowls are for protection and to expel demons who are hurting someone or injuring someone, or to keep the evil eye away, or for children, almost every child wore an amulet so that they wouldn't get sick. So you're going to, I mean, what they call healers are writing amulets. It's not that they didn't know about bacteria and they didn't have much they could do for healing, but they wrote these bowls, these incantations, and the Talmud talks about this problem with the Bible says you should not allow a sorceress to live. And how do they resolve that problem? They say, oh, the sorcery that the Bible is talking about is the way of the Amorites. You do research, there's no such people as the Amorites. The Amorites were the name of these non-existent people who do the magic the Jews aren't allowed to do. So if Jews are doing it, if Jewish women are doing healing and protection and that kind of magic, then obviously that is not what the Bible forbids. Frankly, Judaism is wide open for you can violate almost any law to save a person's life. And this was part of that. But also the rabbis themselves did magic. Rav Hisda cast spells. They felt that the rabbis on the courts should know enough magic that if a sorceress should show up and try to influence the court proceedings, the rabbis would be able to cast their spells and not let her do that. There was so much information and actual spells to that the rabbis would teach. There were, frankly, more names of demons in the Talmud than there are names of women. And the rabbis regularly encounter them and battle them. And I was really quite astonished at the breadth of sorcery and magic, which all we, you know, as far as we know, wait, you're not supposed to do that. But they're doing it.
And there were love spells, too?
Oh, the love spells, yes. Actually, it's funny. When they found these incantation bowls that were love spells, at first they thought, oh, there's been some horrible fire at this house, and because they're all blackened and burnt. And then when they actually read the incantation, it was, just as this bowl burns, may the heart of so-and-so, son of so-and-so, burn for the daughter of so-and-so. Daughter of so-and-so, and may she come to his bed at night, may they marry, Sometimes they were somewhat risque, saying what they should do in the bed at night. And there's even a few of them that were for two men.
That's a shocker.
Yes. I mean, apparently things weren't that different back in those days as we might imagine.
And are you going to continue on with book two?
Yes. Book one is Enchantress, is Apprentice. Because I have to start the novel when she's a child. I have to have that scene with the two suitors. So it also includes, how does she decide to be a sorceress? Okay, there's people in her family who are, but she still has to make a decision. How does she train? Is there like Hogwarts in Babylonia? And that the book one is essentially with her first husband and her starting on the path to become an enchantress. And then in book two, she makes the decision she is really going to commit herself to this, despite the fact that once, as you become more powerful, you will have more enemies. You will have more other sorceresses who are threatened by your power. And she will marry the second husband in book two. So the adventure continues in the second one.
All right. Well, this is fascinating stuff. I loved reading your book, and I'm looking forward to the next one. Rav Hisda's Daughter, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure to be here, and I thank you very much for inviting me.